Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome to our program. We are glad you're along here for Thursday, the fourth day of August. We want to remind our pop-up stories enthusiasts or anybody who likes hearing a good first-person true story told by somebody with a story to tell that next Wednesday evening we will be at Valley Court Park in East Lansing. The theme for our storytellers is the call of the wild. So stories of the outdoors, nature, wildlife, everybody has one of those, right? We will be hearing them starting at 7 o'clock next Wednesday night, Valley Court Park, East Lansing, and that will be just before the city of East Lansing airs a movie here at Where the Wild Things Are, as it turns out, 9 o'clock there in East Lansing. Well, speaking of the wild, health officials say they are treating a Washtenaw County resident for Lyme disease. They believe it's the first case to originate from ticks in that county and not from travel out west. What other places in Michigan might be at risk? And what about the Lansing area? To tell us more, we welcome MSU entomologist Howard Russell. Mr. Russell, welcome.
Good morning, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Some context for starters. Remind our listeners what insect is responsible for infecting people with Lyme disease.
Well, it's not really an insect. It's a tick.
And ticks are not insects.
Ticks are not insects.
Okay. They don't have six legs?
They're actually a mite. They have eight legs.
Very interesting. Okay.
So
I stand corrected.
There's only one species of tick that occurs in Michigan that transmits Lyme disease, and that is the black-legged tick, also known as the deer tick, scientifically known as Ixodes scapularis.
Okay. Can you give us a size? How big is this tick, or small, as the case may be?
The females, of course, are adult females are a little over an eighth of an inch long.
Okay. At what stage are they most likely to transmit Lyme disease?
From what I understand from the Michigan Department of Community Health, it's the NIMP stage that is most likely to transmit Lyme disease.
Okay.
Our ticks, all the ticks that I know of that occur in Michigan are what we call three-host ticks, so they have to feed on three hosts during their lifetime to reach the adult stage.
Oh, interesting.
And Lyme disease is not something that can be passed from the mother female tick onto her offspring. The larvae have to feed on an infected mouse, which in Michigan is generally the white-footed deer mouse, serves as the primary reservoir of the Lyme disease pathogen.
Well, what triggered this story here is the diagnosis of a case of Lyme disease in Washtenaw County, again, the first that originated from a bite in that county, according to health officials. Other people have contracted Lyme disease in Michigan, but it's typically been, often in the past at least, historically, it's been from travel out west. I know that started to change in recent years, but where does the deer tick live? Can you avoid it if you avoid certain areas?
Well, there are certain areas of the state where it's a lot more prevalent. The western UP has had high populations of deer ticks for the past few decades. Over the last 10 years, we've seen a general increase in the deer tick along the shore of Lake Michigan in the lower peninsula. And there is a certain percentage of those ticks that transmit the disease. And from what I understand from the Department of Community Health, there are locally acquired Lyme disease cases from the West Coast, those counties that border Lake Michigan from Berrien County all the way up to Traverse City.
But that raises an interesting point. Just because you're bitten by a black-legged deer tick doesn't necessarily mean that it's carrying Lyme disease. It's not a done deal. Do we understand what percentage of the black-legged ticks actually carry the disease?
It probably depends on what location you're looking at. The last data I saw from the Western UP suggested anywhere from 30 to 50% of the ticks carry the pathogen that causes Lyme disease.
Okay.
My guess is it's probably a little less than that along the coast of Lake Michigan, but still, it wouldn't surprise me. It's anywhere from 20 to 30% of those ticks carry the pathogen as well.
Well, Lyme disease is a terrible disorder. It's nothing to mess around with. Certainly, if you're bitten by a deer tick, it's best to be checked out by a doctor. What accounts for the spread of these ticks or the rise in the tick population?
No one knows for sure. They're picked up and they hitchhike on birds. And if you look at other states, and the deer tick is not the only tick that's increased throughout the Lower Peninsula. The dog tick, which is far more common than their deer tick, was relatively rare in the southern part of the Lower Peninsula 10, 15 years ago. But in that time, we've seen a general increase in that tick species, the American dog tick, as well as the deer tick throughout the Lower Peninsula. No one really knows why, and there's no reason why we shouldn't have had ticks in the past around here. If you look at neighboring states that have a similar climate, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, and even New York, they've always supported, those areas have always had large numbers of ticks as well.
We are talking with Howard Russell, entomologist here at Michigan State University, about Lyme disease, and more specifically, the ticks that carry Lyme disease here in Michigan, Washtenaw County. Health officials say they are treating a resident for Lyme disease that was thought to originate in Washtenaw County. Previous cases likely originated from tick bites elsewhere, including out west. What do we do about this? Is there something that can be done to stop the spread of ticks or to reduce the infected number of ticks?
I don't believe there is. I mean, ticks are going to spread on their own as a matter of natural biology. They're going to move into new areas and spread as long as the climatic conditions favor their reproduction and their spread. Then I don't think there's anything that people can do about that.
We hear about insect repellent. That seems to make perfect sense. What does insect repellent work against these infected ticks?
Well, the common insect repellent, the active ingredient DEET that you find in products like deep wood offs and cutters, isn't as effective as, say, permethrin, which is sold as specifically as tick repellents. And there are several advantages to permethrin over DEET. One, DEET has to be applied to the skin, has to be reapplied several hours to be effective. It's not really that great of a repellent, whereas permethrin is applied to your clothes, and it will remain effective until the next washing of a pair of jeans or a pair of shorts or whatever. And I guess that one of the things I'd like to share with your listeners this morning, Mark, is that tick inspections are really important. If you're in an area, if you've been in an area where you've acquired and found ticks before, it's really important to inspect everybody that's been in that area, including the dog, the kids, the wife, everybody.
Mm-hmm. And visual inspection.
Visual inspection.
A tick check. We do them. We do them every summer up north.
Right. And because especially with Lyme disease, the pathogen, it takes quite a while to migrate from the tick through the mouth parts and into the person being bitten. So removing a deer tick within 48 hours of its attachment greatly reduces one's chances of actually acquiring the disease.
Important point. Just because you've been bitten by an infected tick, if you act promptly enough, you could mitigate the impact.
That's correct.
Is it conceivable that if you spend all of your time in urban areas, let's say, are you pretty much guaranteed never to encounter a tick? I mean, are you only going to encounter a tick if you're out in wooded areas, that kind of thing?
I think it reduces your chances, but if it depends on what you consider urban and or nearby wooded areas. I know Fenner Arboretum has a fair number of deer ticks present in that area. Mm-hmm. Would you consider that urban or would you consider that wooded?
Right.
So you don't have to go far from the city to find deer ticks.
To encounter deer ticks.
At least in the Lansing area.
Well, here's another geographical question for you, Howard. Washtenaw County is not that far from Ingham County. You've said deer ticks exist in Fenner Arboretum. How concerned should we be about a rise in the tick population here in Ingham County?
Well, I don't think you should.
You're saying they're here already. So
that's correct. I've removed them from my dog. 5 years ago, I had a deer tick. I found a deer tick on my dog. My colleague found a deer tick on her dog that had been out to Rose Lake. recreational area out there. So, and I haven't really altered how I approach the outdoors. I certainly don't want people to stay inside because they're fearful of ticks.
Mm-hmm. I want to add, and you're not a physician, you're an insect guy, but if you've been bitten by a tick infected with Lyme disease, what are the symptoms? When do you know you've got a problem?
Well, in half the people that are bitten, there's a distinctive rash that occurs called a bullseye rash, and it's pretty distinctive, but that's only half the people. And then there are flu-like symptoms, sore throat, aching muscles, fever, that are often associated with early onset Lyme disease.
So you may not have the bullseye rash, but you've still conceivably contracted Lyme disease.
That's correct. Okay. And because the nymphal stage is the one most likely to transmit the disease, and nymph deer ticks are very, very small. Poppy seed size. Mm-hmm. You may not even realize you've been bitten by a tick because they're so small.
Can Lyme disease be treated with antibiotics?
Very successfully, especially in the early stages of the disease.
Okay. But it's still nothing to mess around with. The symptoms are awful. Virtually all of our listeners have heard of Lyme disease, but the symptoms vary, as you point out, sometimes are hard to diagnose. We spoke with a Holly resident, Eileen Craven, describe her son AJ's symptoms when he was just 7 years old. Let's listen to that.
He was a lot more tired. Things weren't clicking as quickly for him as they used to be. Most of it was that he was very pale. He had no color to his face, not even in his lips. And he was just tired all the time. He just didn't have any energy at all.
So clearly, nothing to mess around with here. I've spoken with people before who've suffered for years because of Lyme disease. We want to thank Howard Russell for his help helping us understand the insects that play the role here, the black-legged or deer ticks here in Michigan. I guess your best advice is to stay vigilant.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Howard. Coming up on Current State, we welcome Lansing City Councilman Adam Hussein, 3rd Ward Council member, to talk about the South Washington Park apartment improvements, the Southwest Initiative, the 5th iteration of a city marijuana ordinance, and more. That's on the way on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State on WKAR. Our summer travel series continues today, and WKAR's Peter Wharf takes us to Dearborn for a bit of living history.
It's a perfect summer afternoon in Michigan. 85 degrees, low humidity, bright blue sky, a few puffy clouds. And on a grassy hill under the shade of towering oaks and locust trees, I'm watching a baseball game. Historic baseball, played every weekend at 1:30 into August at Dearborn's Greenfield Village. The two resident teams are playing today. It's the Nationals versus the La-Di-Das. Historic baseball seasons culminate in a championship series at season's end. Marcus Dixon has been an umpire in past championship games at the Village.
So we have teams who are playing baseball the way it was played in 1867, with the equipment, with the rules, with the uniforms, to try to recreate the game in the days before there was professional baseball, when it was an amateur game, my town against your town for the glory and honor of our town.
Historic baseball at Greenfield Village is a time machine. Players wear period button-up long-sleeve uniforms, sleeves rolled up today, with apologies to the ladies. They play by 1867 rules, like balls played off branches hanging over fair territory. An out's called when caught off the first bounce, when it's foul. Don't worry, the players will get it right. More on that later. There's no pitcher's mound, and gloves are optional, not preferred. But Marcus Dixon feels the appeal of historic baseball goes much deeper.
Historic baseball is not just old rules. It's not just old equipment. It's also taking you to a different time when the world was different. The way that people thought about honesty, the way that people thought about competition was different. The games were played hard. The clubs who played wanted to win, but they certainly wanted to win fairly. It's really interesting when people do come to see a historic baseball game, how quickly they become attached to the game. I can't count the number of times someone has said to me, this is so much more fun than going to see a major league game. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One is that the game is exciting. They say people who are playing not because they're being paid millions of dollars, but because they really, really love this game.
Dixon continues to explore historic baseball's creed of fair play. This time I caught him between innings taking a break from his la-di-da's catcher's position.
The things that are appealing to me most of all is that this is a game where you're expected to play fairly. If you know you're out, you leave the field. If you know you're not out and the umpire calls you out, you tip your hat and you leave the field. And if you were to not do that, if you were to know that you were out and stay on the field, people wouldn't want you to play. This is a game where in the championship game in the World Tournament, there was a play where the umpire called a runner out on first, and the first baseman said, no, sir, the throw pulled my foot off the base. My foot was not on the base. The runner was not out in the championship game. And everybody said that's exactly the right thing to do. And so that's the kind of game I want to play.
That guy in the background with the running color commentary is Ken Jacobs. He's wearing a white shirt and floppy black bow tie, light gray trousers and vest, and a cream-colored stovepipe hat, sort of a huskier Abe Lincoln in negative. You can hear Ken all across the field. There's a speaker hidden in a wooden box that looks sort of like it might cover an old well or something. He's another guy that has the game deep in his DNA. And as a bonus, Ken is funny.
Right down. Mr. Robert just kind of slowed down there. I don't thought he was going to throw, but I think he would look more like modern dancing or something.
As Greenfield Village's steam locomotive passes by, players stop in mid-inning for huzzas to the Iron Horse. This happens a few times every game. Announcer Ken Jacobs has played other roles on the historic baseball field. In this case, he runs our time machine from the 1860s to about 1912. Ken takes the field for a pregame speech, this time wearing a dark gray suit and round spectacles. His character this time, Teddy Roosevelt.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I love this game of baseball, and I'm honored that the National League and the American League have honored me with a golden pass to go and see their games anytime. But I'd rather see fellows like this. You know, my sons Kermit and Quentin play on the White House lawn occasionally, or they did when we were in the White House, and we hope we're going to be back there soon. And I'm glad to report 23-4 was the score for Quentin's team and Kermit's team. We were honored to win, right there on the White House lawn. Now, I'm more of a boxer myself. I'm in it for the fight. And I'll tell you what, we have election in front of us for 12, and I hope you'll be in it for the fight and vote for the Bull Moose Party, fellas, so we can get all these ladies to vote for us in 16 when we win women's suffrage.
After the fifth inning, I also had a chance to speak with one of the guys on the other team, the Nationals. Jack Spiteman got into the historic game a few years back. He plays outfield.
A friend that I played softball with got on the year before, and he let me know that they had an opening. I came and tried out and got on the team. You really have to have two things to play. You have to know how to play baseball, but the most important thing is to be able to interact with the crowd.
Well, we finished. The Dodgers crowd,
because what we want to do is have an instructional gear. Teach people about the way baseball was played back in 1867 and the different rules and how they're different from today. And it's such a great environment with, you know, being here at Greenfield Village, the history they have, so.
The history and the ways of days gone by, says Jack Spiteman, far removed from scenes like this. What many consider one of the game's most calculating and controversial acts, the Pine Tar incident, which started with a home run by a Hall of Famer.
George Brett has just homered, and Billy Martin and the Yankees want the bat. Look at Martin.
Well, what they're talking about, Frank, is that he's got too much pine tar, and you've got to have a certain amount of distance from the trademark of the bat and the pine tar. They might be going to call George Brett out.
Well, he is. He's winning. He's out.
Yes, sir.
Brett is out. Look at this. Brett is out.
And he's steaming mad.
He is out and having to be forcibly restrained from hitting plate umpire Tim McClellan.
From George Brett and Billy Martin back to Jack Spiteman.
Honestly, what I like is it's a gentleman's game. We're on our honor out there. If you make a catch, if you tag somebody out, you state that, and generally people agree. We're playing, you know, we're not playing for money. We're playing for the love of the game, for the sport. Like I said, it's a gentleman's game. We play a full nine innings because it would be ungentlemanly to quit in the ninth inning, okay? That kind of thing. And it's just kind of lacking in today's society. Honestly, I really enjoy, and I enjoy the exercise, obviously, the chance that I can get out here and play. And I have to get out there and play left field again.
I'll talk to you later. Thanks.
This year's World Tournament of Historic Baseball is Saturday and Sunday, August 13th and 14th at Greenfield Village. For Current State, I'm Peter Wharf.
Well, they go for the fourth out, but they really don't need it. Our progress of our game stopped by progress out there. Let's give them three cheers and get them on their way. Hip, hip, hooray! Hip, hip, hooray! Hip, hip, hooray! Hip, hip, hooray!
And coming up on Current State, long before the Game of Thrones had its Queen of Thorns, Oscar Wilde gifted verbal barbs to the character of Lady Bracknell in his classic play, The Importance of Being Earnest. We'll learn more about an upcoming production coming to the Carytown Concert House in Ann Arbor, which utilizes gender-blind casting, including for Lady Bracknell herself. That's after the break on Current State. Point out, if you're making plans to make it to the East Lansing Folk Festival here the end of next week and into the weekend after this weekend, Current State will be broadcasting live down there between 6 and 7, which we've done for the last several years. Be looking for us, live music and other guests here as Current State goes live at the East Lansing Folk Festival here 1 week from Friday, 6 to 7 p.m. will be set up right at Albert Avenue and Grove Street, okay? So we hope, if you're making plans, that you will seek us out. We've been discussing a variety of issues concerning the Lansing City Council lately here on Current State. We want to welcome Adam Hussein, who serves on the council as a representative of the 3rd Ward, Southwest Lansing. His name has come up quite a bit lately in our discussions about the Southwest Initiative, a marijuana ordinance, the South Washington Park apartments, and other topics. Adam Hussein, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for the opportunity.
We are at work. I was originally going to start with the South Washington Park apartments because you've been pretty directly involved in that. But given what's happened just in recent days involving the evolution of a marijuana ordinance here for Lansing, I'm under the impression the city's at work now on a fifth iteration of a marijuana ordinance. Generally, from your perspective, Adam, where is the city in this process, and what are your priorities in this process?
Let me just provide just a bit of context, because to truly understand where I'm at, you have to understand the history, and your listeners have to understand that. So we're 8 years at this point past, post-referendum, I should say. So in 2008, the voters in Michigan approved the Michigan Medical Marijuana Act. And the idea was that we were going to provide those individuals with debilitating conditions medical options to alleviate some of those chronic pains associated with that. Unfortunately, that ordinance, or I should say that state statute, I'm sorry, was silent on dispensaries. And so some savvy individuals, some business-minded individuals, if you will, I think saw an opportunity. And so we started to see these dispensaries crop up. Well, a number of municipalities started to take kind of reactionary, if you will, stances, and they started to pass moratoriums. They started to pass outright bans. And the city of Lansing in 2010 passed a moratorium. What that allowed the city to do, and I should say the city council, was to craft a medical marijuana ordinance. And in 2011, that ordinance was crafted, it was passed, and it went to an effect. The problem was that same year, there was an appellate court decision that essentially struck down the legality of medical marijuana dispensaries. And so the attorney general comes in and essentially says that prosecutors can start to shut down these dispensaries using local public nuisance laws. 2013, in a case known as Michigan versus McQueen, the Supreme Court essentially upheld that decision. But right here in Lansing, we never actually enforced any of that. We did send a cease and desist letter out in 2011. Our attorney at the time was Brick Smith. And out of the 70 dispensaries, 50 did willfully close down. 20 remained. And as I think they saw, essentially, that this would not be enforced. Some of these decisions and some of these opinions would not be enforced. We saw that number continue to balloon. And again, we are at that 70 number. So I want to applaud the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce. I want to applaud Rejuvenating South Lansing, my colleagues on public safety, because there started to be this clamor for both a moratorium, which did go in effect in this past May, and then an ordinance. Okay, so the question was this, you know, if we're not going to shut these dispensaries down, can we put something that's enforceable in place? Because we are being told that the 2011 ordinance is not enforceable. So the Office of the State Attorney got busy, and they have presented us with a, like you said, a few different drafts. We are working on draft number 4 right now. So we're vetting this thing line by line, page by page. And what will happen is they'll take essentially that input, if you will, and then this is my understanding, they will provide us with a fifth draft based on some of the suggestions
okay,
by the committee.
So I was right. It is basically, you expect a fifth
sure.
draft. What, in your view, Adam, what does an ordinance have to address?
I think the reality is we cannot have an industry that is completely unregulated and unchecked in this city. Okay, we have to know. My primary concern is that the individuals that are accessing this medicinal marijuana, that they are able to access it in a safe and secure way, that they know what they're ingesting, they know that what they're ingesting is safe. And so that's number one. Number two, we have to do this in a way that protects the neighborhoods, that protect our corridors, adjacent businesses. Again, and we want to enhance the credibility of this industry. Right now, there is not a lot of credibility. There are some dispensary owners, essentially, that are making a mockery of the law. So there are some things that we want to do with this ordinance to, again, provide safe and secure access while protecting neighborhoods and while protecting our corridors.
Does the number of marijuana businesses need to go down in Lansing, and should that be addressed by an ordinance?
Well, if you're going to ask me personally, do I think 70 is excessive? I do. I do. Even in the legislative intent of this ordinance, the reality is that we are looking at providing safe and secure access to the residents in Lansing, okay, and we are trying to provide for public health and welfare for the residents in Lansing. I don't think it is our job to essentially provide the medicinal marijuana need for the entire state of Michigan, or at least mid-Michigan. So personally, yes, I believe we have too many. With that said, what I am interested in seeing through this ordinance is those that are credible, those that can make it through the vetting process, that those are the dispensaries that remain open. And if it ends up being 40, I guess it's 40. If it ends up being 20, it's 20.
What if it ends up being 60 or 70?
Again, on a personal level, I have an issue with that. But again, you know, we're looking at zoning. We're looking at spatial limitations. We're looking at, so I don't think that happens. The reality is this. The reason we have 70 mark is because, again, there is no vetting process. There is no licensing process. Everybody that has a dream of opening a restaurant in the city of Lansing can't do that. I mean, you have to be qualified. There are hoops you have to jump through there.
Do you think that the proposed fee of $5,000, there would be, what's being considered is a fee, $5,000 fee and a $10,000 renewal fee every year to renew the license. Do you think do you support that proposal, and would that cut the number of marijuana businesses down, do you think?
So I guess I have a couple of things to discuss here. Number one, this is all theoretical at this point. So we're discussing, obviously, those application fees. Obviously, we're discussing the renewal fees. Nothing is set in stone at this point. And so we're, you know, and we have to take a look at what is the cost essentially of doing business. It takes a lot of money for us to vet these applicants. To make sure that these dispensaries are in compliance and things of that nature. So we have to have the money to have that enforcement piece so that we can actually enforce this ordinance once it's on the books. But the other thing is that, you know, this idea that this is the application fee, the renewal fee, that this is too excessive. You know, I've been to a number of dispensaries. I've tried to inform myself as best I possibly can. So I've talked to the patient advocates. I've talked to the neighborhood leaders. I've been in several dispensaries. And they've been pretty candid that they are making quite a bit of money. As a matter of fact, one dispensary owner told me he's pulling down about $10,000 a day. So the money is there to pay these types of fees, absolutely.
Well, that would suggest that more than 40 of these businesses may well be able to handle the registration and license renewal fees. How do you feel about that?
Again, for me, it's, you know, and that's not even the piece of the ordinance that I've been focused on. Again, I'm focused on the vetting of the applicants. I'm focused on the spatial limitations, making sure that these aren't near churches and parks and schools. And so that's the part I think that is really going to mitigate some of that number.
But you're prepared to let, pardon me, the business landscape and business owners capacity to pay these fees. If it ends up being 55 to 70, what I'm hearing you say is you're okay with it. You would prefer many fewer, but if it turns out to be 55 to 70, then you're prepared to roll with that.
Well, I don't want to mix messages. I am not okay with 55 to 70. And I believe that the ordinance, even as written today, without us going in there and obviously making some changes and amending that chapter as written, even today, it is not going to allow Mark for 55 to 70.
Okay.
Simply because of the zoning, the spatial limitations, it's just not going to happen.
I'm cribbing a little bit from Eric Lacey's reporting in the Lansing State Journal. Apparently, Police Chief Mike Yankowski said on Tuesday that enforcement of a medical marijuana ordinance would be a challenge for the Lansing Police, but not impossible. And apparently the department is currently down about 20 officers, but Chief Yankowski says he's optimistic that about 15 officers will be hired by August 22nd. So that's pretty soon. Do you have concerns about enforcement should an ordinance move forward?
Of course I do, because we've seen things obviously in the past not be enforced. But again, I think this collective voice that is emerging in Lansing is loud enough that I believe our administration will prioritize this. And we are actually having Chief Yankowski into our Public Safety Committee on Friday. And of course, we plan on asking him some questions, some very deliberate questions about this ordinance and the enforcement of this ordinance. But with that said, I was encouraged as well. So I did read that report, that just came out yesterday. So I'm encouraged. Again, we'll continue to work with Mike and the LPD to make sure that this is enforced.
You've been involved in the South Washington Park Apartments issues lately. We've been discussing them here on Current State. This is a public housing apartment complex, a HUD property overseen by the Lansing Housing Commission, which has experienced historically a lot of problems, poor conditions, violence, poor security. We had representatives of the Housing Commission on Current State recently, Patricia Baines-Lake, its executive director, and Tony Baltimore, the board president. They said they were eager to work with residents on solutions to the problems the complex faces. Talk to us about what are your thoughts on the way forward here?
Well, and again, I'm glad you provided that context. This is not a new issue. I think that's part of the problem. So this dates all the way back to 2010. So in January, when I came on as council representative for the Third Ward, now I'm their direct representative, they're calling me. It afforded me the opportunity to get in there. It afforded me the opportunity to get in there and to experience some of the issues, I think, firsthand. And obviously the violence, obviously some of the unsanitary conditions. I was invited into unit after unit, and there were serious issues with regards to bed bugs and just general issues with upkeep. So moving forward, I'll tell you what. I want to be clear here too. 95 to 96% of the individuals that live specifically at 3200, I believe, are good individuals. They're lease compliant, and so I do not want to paint this picture of the individuals there as everybody is out of control and everybody's breaking their lease and everybody's bringing in outsiders to prey on the few good actors, if you will. There are some incredible individuals at 3200 South Washington, and some individuals that actually would consider friends at this point. Moving forward, what we would like to see is the Lansing Housing Commission, and I'm working at this point with Tony Baltimore in earnest, but we would like them to clean some things up, if you will. I think they need a top-down analysis of their employees, to be quite frank. And I think because these issues have been allowed to persist for so long, I think the question has to be asked, who needs to go?
And how many employees are we talking about?
It's tough to say right now, and I broke this issue.
How many employees does the complex have?
Well, and here's the issue, and I'm talking LHC, so Lansing Housing Commission, kind of across the board. It's tough to tell right now because if you go on their site, there are a number of vacancies, but then again, the website's not updated. So I really don't know. If you're talking about 3,200, essentially what you have is an asset manager, an assistant asset manager, you have a part-time essentially secretary, and then you have three general maintenance staff. But in terms of the Lansing Housing Commission and some of the systemic issues that have been allowed to persist within the Lansing Housing Commission, I think there needs to be a top-down analysis of all employees, not just those individuals that are directly involved with 3,200, because they own and operate five properties, and many of these properties are troubled, to be quite frank.
So six employees altogether dealing directly with South Washington Park Apartments.
If fully manned.
Yeah.
That's my understanding, yes.
Now, I'm hearing that Patricia Baines Lake may be stepping down from the Housing Commission.
She is,
as well.
And candidly speaking, Mark, I think that provides the Lansing Housing Commission with a tremendous opportunity. I think what we're going to do here, what we hope to see, is a casting of a wide net, the bringing in of truly some highly qualified individuals that have proven track records of turning entities around, such as the Lansing Housing Commission, that have seen better days. And so, again, candidly speaking, I think they have a fantastic opportunity in front of them. I would hate to see them, honestly, promote from within. I would like to see, and obviously they don't answer to me, but I would like to see the mayor and Tony Baltimore and that board of commissioners get serious about bringing somebody in from the outside that has fresh ideas and a new perspective and that can look at things objectively and, again, conduct something like a top-down analysis and determine who needs to go, who needs to stay, who can we scaffold and support to make sure that they're on these sites facilitating the change that these residents deserve. They deserve a good, safe, appropriate place to live.
Earlier this year, you went to South Washington Park, and
sure.
And I understand you were threatened during your visit there. Can you describe what happened and what you took from that experience?
Well, I was knocking doors. I was very deliberate about when I went. I went during weekdays. I went during the weeknight. I went on the weekend. I wanted to see what were the challenges. Did it elevate when management wasn't on site? And this happened to be at night. And I was up on the fifth floor, and I was knocking on doors. It was clear what I was doing because I was leaving flyers on doors that individuals hadn't answered essentially the door. And somebody did come up and say that if I didn't get off the property, they would shoot me. Now, understand, again, that was one person. Every other door I knocked on, when I could get somebody to answer that door and I talked to them, they were fantastic. They invited me into their units. But they were very candid, too. They said that, essentially what's being allowed is 4-5% of the individuals that are there that aren't lease compliant, that aren't adhering essentially to the occupancy agreement, a piece of the lease, that they're bringing in outsiders that are preying on this very vulnerable demographic. You're talking about seniors, talking about individuals with disabilities. You're talking about single parents that are trying to raise young children. And for some people, that is appealing in terms of being able to prey upon that demographic. So that did happen. I did file a police report. But again, that is not the picture we want to paint of the people at 3,200.
Did that incident change your thoughts, though, as to what needs to happen at South Washington Park?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, Mark, one of the biggest things is, we've talked about empowering the residents there, making them, or I should say scaffolding a neighborhood watch group or scaffolding a resident council group or something of that nature. But the reality is we have to get the bad actors out first. We have to start making sure that we're looking at those screening procedures. We're looking at those eviction policies and we get that 5-6% out, because the reality is they are running roughshod over that property. And so there are a lot of individuals that fear retaliation because they're threatened with their life.
How many bad actors are there?
Again, I'd say, you have five floors, you have 188 units, and I would say there's probably anywhere from 4-6%.
A HUD complaint was filed, and you see changes at the Lansing Housing Commission as instrumental in that process?
I think it's absolutely imperative. Yeah.
Does the atmosphere at the Housing Commission need to change before you can deal with those bad actors?
I think absolutely. And that's why I say I hope that, and Tony Baltimore has been very responsive over these last few weeks. We've been sitting down, we've been meeting, we're trying to work again with each other in earnest. But again, I don't think you can promote somebody from within, somebody that has been kind of submerged in that failed culture, and think that things are going to change. Mm. I really don't believe that.
A HUD complaint was filed against the city council recently over the Sabori development plan for Old Town. Do you know what the status of that complaint is?
In terms of the HUD complaint, my understanding is there's been no movement.
And you were one of four on the council who voted against the Sabori development. Carol Wood explained to us this wasn't a vote against the development completely, but it was specifically because of the level of tax breaks that Mr. Sabori wanted for the development. Was that your reasoning when voting? Was that your reasoning as well?
Well, you know, I have to tread lightly here because there is a federal lawsuit that has been filed by the developer. And so what I'll tell you is just kind of generally speaking, this isn't something new, Mark, to this council. Council has been questioning the sustainability of these pilots since 1998. There's been moratoriums, ordinances. And so in 2016, here we are facing a $600 million in excess of unfunded liability. We've cut $60 million from the general fund over the last 10 years. We're doing less with less. And so the question is, of the 4% variety, can we sustain pilots? I don't believe we can. I've not lost one wink of sleep over my vote, and I wouldn't vote differently if it was today.
I wound you up with a big issue here, and I've got to cut you short. But right. We really appreciate your time here today. You've explained a lot of things. Adam Hussein serves on the Lansing City Council as a representative of the 3rd Ward. Thank you, Adam.
Thanks a lot.
It's Current State on WKAR. A classic Oscar Wilde play is coming to the Carytown Concert House in Ann Arbor this weekend, but it has an interesting inversion. The artistic director of the Brass Tacks Ensemble spoke with Current State's Jamie Paisley about what he did for Wilde's play, The Importance of Being Earnest. Jamie, what decision was that exactly?
Well, he cast it essentially gender blind, which is to say the lead male roles of Jack and Algernon. They're portrayed by women, and those infamous lines of Lady Bracknell are actually delivered by a man. However, for the Brass Tacks artistic director, James Ingajola, this gender-bending casting was not, you know, not a political decision, not a commentary on Oscar Wilde's imprisonment on the grounds of his homosexuality. Instead, well, it came about when Ingajola was auditioning the performers.
It's less a comment on this show and more comment, I guess, on theater in general. A lot of times, women walk away empty-handed because you have a huge number of women auditioning, and there are few female roles. So I went into this process thinking, you know, I'm going to keep it open. I'm going to try and cast Lady Bracknell as a woman because I know that it's frequently cast as a man. And what ended up happening is I had a huge number of women audition and very few men. And, yeah, I did decide at that moment that I'd hate to see all these women walk away empty-handed. And they're really good. They're really good actresses. So let's give them roles. Let's give them all the roles, and we did have a few men that were good, so I cast one of the men in Lady Bracknell because that seemed the most obvious role for a man if you're going to cast everybody else as a woman.
Well, it will not be long before you are of age and free from the restraints of your guardian.
According to the terms of her grandfather's will, she does not come legally of age until she is 35.
That does not seem to me to be a grave objection. 35 is a very attractive age. London society is full of women of the very highest birth who have, of their own free choice, remained 35 for years.
For the Brass Tacks Ensemble, and by the way, that's tax spelled T-A-C-K-S, not that thing everybody pays April 15th. Well, among the aims of the Brass Tacks Ensemble is to, quote, strip away the excess and focus on the essentials of theater.
It starts with a focus on sort of the relationship between the actor, the text, and the audience. So before we start adding things like set elements or costume elements or anything like that, we like to have a solid foundation and make sure the story is being told on a very basic level. But also I like to think of it as theater of the imagination in a way, keeping away from set elements and prop elements and costume elements, using them in a suggestive manner, something to evoke something in the audience's mind. As my colleague Isaac Ellis says, any dragon that we create on stage is not going to be as fantastic and wonderful as the one that you create in your mind. So we're trying to evoke images and evoke ideas rather than simply show them to you. And I think that's a very basic element of theater.
According to the Brass Tacks artistic director, James Ingajola, it is that basicness which serves as a great juxtaposition when thinking about the Victorian era, which pervades Oscar Wilde's play, The Importance of Being Earnest.
A lot of the play is about the relationship between style and substance. We do have small set and small prop pieces, but they're not complete, as it were. An example might be that we would have a tea setting with plates and cups and a teapot, but there's no food, and there's no tea. So you have what is the ritual, the tea service, but you don't have any substance, anything to eat or drink. And I think that's a major theme of the play, is that, and many characters say it throughout, that, you know, style more than substance is the essential thing, which is an inversion of our own, or we like to think it's an inversion of our own living. It's a parody of a lot of the theater of the time. It relies heavily on inversion, and the characters hold things that we would think are trivial important. I mean, they hold meals and flowers in your lapel as importantly, as earnestly, as we would hold love and death. And, you know, they take things, they raise the stakes of the trivial things. And it is a farce to a degree. I mean, you have these characters who live solely for pleasure, and they concoct these ridiculous situations, disguising themselves and creating these imaginary brothers and imaginary invalids that they'd take care of, in order to pursue their own selfish desires.
One of the most enduring elements of Oscar Wilde's play, The Importance of Being Earnest, is the sharp wit of the characters, particularly that of Lady Bracknell.
I've always been of opinion that a man who desires to get married should know either everything or nothing. Which do you know?
I know nothing, Lady Bracknell.
I'm pleased to hear it. I do not approve of anything that tampers with natural ignorance. Ignorance is like a delicate, exotic fruit. Touch it, and the bloom is gone. The whole theory of modern education is radically unsound. Fortunately, in England, at any rate, education produces no effect whatsoever. If it did, it would prove a serious danger to the upper classes and probably lead to acts of violence in Grosvenor Square.
Again, James Ingajola of the Brass Tacks Ensemble in Ann Arbor.
I think, if anything, the wit of the play is the biggest draw. I mean, I've seen and read more complicated farces than The Importance of Being Earnest, but it is the wit that Oscar Wilde uses. And yeah, Lady Bracknell and Algernon are the two main conduits of that wit. It's their natural way of speaking, which is maybe the hardest part of this production process, the rehearsal process for us, was to realize that the characters don't realize how funny they are, and that makes it funnier. That they don't realize how scathing or occasionally how ridiculous they sound. And that's where a lot of the comedy is, because I think a lot of times we see productions either of this play or of other sort of farces, particularly Tom Stoppard, and where the language is amazingly funny, amazingly witty. The production will add so many elements, so many physical elements, rather than focus on the acting and focus on the story and allow the wit to be a character trait rather than just an added funny bit. That's part of the stripping away for us, too, is that I didn't want to add too many bits. I wanted to actually play this as naturalistically as possible. And oddly enough, that brings out the comedy even more. That brings out those sharp barbs from Lady Bracknell all the more, because it becomes a character trait and not just an isolated joke, as it were.
We've been speaking with James Ingajola about the Brass Tacks Ensemble, which he is a co-founder and current artistic director of, about the upcoming performance of The Importance of Being Earnest this weekend at the Kerrytown Concert Halls. More information about the Brass Tacks Ensemble you can find online at btensemble.org Or you can find reservations to the Kerrytown Concert House at kerrytownconcerthouse.com. James, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you very much, too.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Friday on Current State, Flint Mayor Karen Weaver joins me tomorrow morning. This will be after today's State of the City address in Flint. Join us for that. Plus, our Live Music Friday guest is one of the most versatile musicians we've ever had on Current State. Rodney Page plays violin and piano. He DJs, he sings, he raps, he does it all. He's also a music educator who's worked extensively with local school districts. Rodney Page tomorrow here on Live Music Friday on WKAR's Current State. We hope you can join us for that. Peter Worf is our program's executive producer. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is available anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. Everything we do ends up there, as well as at WKAR.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. We'll see you live music Friday here on Current State.